80% of all acts of religious discrimination in the world are directed at Christians. It's a very striking statistic, isn't it? It means any Christian is expecting to live out their faith under pressure. Open Doors speaks about some of those acts. Each month, it says, 322 Christians are killed. 214 churches and Christian properties are destroyed. 772 forms of violence are committed against Christians, and that includes beatings, abductions, rapes, arrests, forced marriages. Pressure comes in various shapes and sizes in various places around the world. For many of us, it may not get beyond verbal harassment, hostile feelings, attitudes, actions. But for some, including some here, it includes loss of friends and family. For others, it includes loss of education and jobs. You know, your faith or your degree. You can't do both. Your faith or your career. There's no room for a Christian in this job. For many around the world, it includes loss of freedom and of life. It means Christians pick up a biography like John's and are reading very attentively when Jesus and his disciples come under pressure. You know, how do they handle it? What lessons for us to learn? What mistakes to avoid? What encouragements to take? And the pressure is on in this chapter as Jesus and Peter face very different trials. Really is a tale of two trials. They're parallel stories. One takes place in Annas's house, the other in the courtyard. And John keeps switching between the home and the fire, the inside and the outside. John the filmmaker would be using a split screen to make his point. And he begins with Jesus. You see in verse 12, they bound Jesus and they brought him first to Annas. Well, as in all things legal, there is a process, but there's huge pressure on the authorities if they're going to get through it in time. You see, the Passover Sabbath is less than 24 hours away. And when that finishes, immediately you head into a 7-day feast of unleavened bread. And in the God culture of the day, no executions during the whole of that time. So if they're going to carry through the execution of Jesus, they have got to, they've got to have him tried and condemned by the Sanhedrin, the religious ruling council, early on the Friday. They've got to get Pilate's confirmation by mid to late morning so that they could get him on the cross by midday and dead and off the cross before sundown heralded the start of the Sabbath. It could be done, but it was going to be very tight. So before the Sanhedrin can get together, Annas has first shot at Jesus to see if he can get something out of it to speed up the process. And as that gets going, John's cameras move outside to Peter. Verse 15, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. No name's given to the other disciple. It's always infuriating when that happens, isn't it? But John actually, drifts through his gospel largely anonymous. The disciple Jesus loved. Another disciple would be typical of him. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, it's not instantly likely that a northern fisherman like John would know the high priest. But when you dig further, not that impossible. The trade in fish from Galilee was known to be a strong one in Jerusalem, and Zebedee fishing, the family business, was big enough to employ more than just family members. If they had a branch office in Jerusalem and John had taken deliveries round, he could have been known to the high priest and know the servant girl he persuades to let Peter in. I mean, whatever the details. You've got to love Peter's heart as well, haven't you? I mean, big enough to come out swinging at the arresting party in the garden, ready to defend Jesus there against hopeless odds. Now it's big enough to want to follow and keep close to Jesus when everyone else but John had fled. a big heart. The trouble is, he's got no idea what to do with it. You know, he tried a sword in the garden, but Jesus had told him that was not the way. And now the same heart is beating, but the head seems empty, completely out of ideas for what he's meant to do. And into some setting like that, the servant girl catches him off guard in verse 17. "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" she asked Peter. And notice the two, you know, as well as John. I mean, the question is loaded, isn't it? It may be sarcastic, but it expects the answer no. It's not a level playing field question. And that's what often throws us, isn't it? We're not faced with the harmlessly neutral. You know, what do you think of Jesus? Or even, do you think there's anything in it? Now, this is, you don't believe that nonsense, do you? You aren't one too, are you? The kind of question that points you to an easy and obvious escape road, and Peter takes it. He replied, "I am not." Easily said, and Peter's in, and he's with the in crowd in verse 18. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they'd made to keep warm, and Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. But the officials are the temple police, and it's soon going to get too hot for Peter to handle. But first, John's cameras, that they switch back to Jesus. And we come to verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. He's concerned to know if they've been radicalized. You know, the Palm Sunday entry to the Capitol looked just like a potential serious uprising. They're in the dark. The threat level is at serious, as we'd say today. Verse 20, "I've spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I said nothing in secret. This is no cult or sect." It's not as if Jesus put on an acceptable face in public and taught something completely different in private. And Jesus follows up by reminding them of the process. Look at verse 21. "Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." See, Jewish trials were meant to be about witnesses. If you find two witnesses who would agree, well, the defense case was almost certainly sunk. And Annas is trying to take a shortcut and grill the defendant. "Get the witnesses," says Jesus. "They shouldn't be hard to find. Give me a fair trial." And that simply gets him his first taste of police brutality that night. Look at verse 22. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. The irony, of course, is that the policeman has just slapped the high priest in the face. But Jesus is unfazed. He goes on in verse 23. "If I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Stick to the rules. Don't try and beat some confession out of me. Give me justice." He doesn't just roll over without making his point, does he? Cue camera switch back to the courtyard again. There's no violence there, no injustice, just natural curiosity. See verse 25. "Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. So they asked him, 'You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?'" The same question as the servant girl had asked, expecting the same answer and getting it. He denied it, saying, "I am not." But things will go from bad to worse for Peter. Staying close to Jesus is going to put him on the spot in ways which the other disciples who fled won't have to face. There's a cost to staying close that Peter's not ready to pay yet. I don't know whether a flame flickers and sort of lights up his features, but you see in verse 26, one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" again, Peter denied it. And it's over. Cut the lights, stop the cameras, the scene's in the can, the contrast is perfectly drawn. Jesus testifies faithfully. Peter denies pathetically. Jesus stands up to the questioners and denies nothing. Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. When the pressure comes, where do we go? See, what do we learn from this? What are the warnings? What are the encouragements? Some of the lessons are tough ones. There's a darkness to what's going on here. And few people come out of it with any credit. Annas seems to be all about the rejection of God. Now, you may have noticed a muddle on the surface about who is actually the high priest. I mean, John is clear that Caiaphas is officially high priest that year, but he keeps speaking as if Annas is too. And the post had become something of a political football when Annas had been sacked by a previous governor. He still managed to get four of his sons into the position, and Caiaphas was his son-in-law. So you can imagine he was viewed as the power behind the throne, the kind of godfather to the high priests, to mix metaphors, high priest emeritus. And he speaks and acts as the official representative of the faith of Israel. You know, a faith that looks all the way back to Abraham will count Moses and David among its former leaders. A faith that knows the Exodus, the promised land, the return from exile as part of its history. He embodies now the faith of a people who have rejected their God. When religious leaders, Christian religious leaders of all kinds even, reject their God, it shocks us. It isn't new, though. It's no surprise to God. He's faced it before. You know, our culture may mean it feels more and more in this country at times, at any rate, that we're living among people who have rejected their God. But there's no need to shipwreck our faith by hitching it to their wagon. Whether they've got title of minister or rector or bishop or archbishop even. If Annas is the rejection of God, Peter is, well, I'd probably call it more the denial of God. Here are shoes we're more familiar with. Not so much deliberate, premeditated rejection. Just the put me on the spot funk, which doesn't stand up for Jesus or with Jesus. Not opening fire on him, not having a go at him, much more ducking below the parapet rather than staying alongside him. Nearly all of us who call ourselves Christians will have had our "you aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" moments. If you've not had one of them, you probably need to get out more. For some, this is because their culture, whether that's in their workplace, their neighborhood, their family even, their culture is very hostile. For others of us, it's really because we are wimps. We need to face it. The question comes our way, and somehow or other, in the nanoseconds before we reply, a whole range of overwhelming feelings sort of flood our brain. You know, what will they think if? What will it mean for me if? What will I say if? And "I am not" is by far the easiest answer to give. There's Annas, there's Peter, and there's Jesus. But as you look at Jesus, really you see something of the weakness of God, if I can put it that way. You can't miss it, really, as you read it. It's not our failure of God now, but more, if you like, a sense of his failure of us. Jesus is like some helpless pawn in the hands of his enemies, tossed from one to another like a shuttlecock. And there they are, bending the system, bending the rules, plotting and delivering the most appalling injustice. Paul speaks of the weakness of God, and I suspect we can all identify with that weakness, the God who apparently was not there when we needed him. God's weakness. God's weakness also appears in the wider world of the atrocities that are daily committed around the world, permitted around the globe. In the spectacle of the needy millions, the starving, the refugees, the abused, the diseased, God, if he really owns the globe, is, it seems, at best weak and limited and clearly not up to the demands of ruling this world. Well, you can understand those thoughts, can't you, as you watch his king being abused and treated the way he is? It's a dark place to leave things. It's not where John ends, but he wants us to taste the dark before he goes any further. Because often in our experience, the dark is all that is tangible. All we can really see and feel is the rejection, the denial, the weakness. But he doesn't stop there. Did you notice how verse 27 ended? Again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, a rooster, a cock, began to crow. Exactly as Jesus had predicted. Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times, he'd said. See, it is dark. It is not out of God's control or purposes. There's a great painting just down the road in the National Gallery by Gerrit van Honthorst. It's called Christ Before the High Priest. And you can see it's dark, deliberately so. Most of the figures are just shadows. Jesus is bound and being interrogated, and the high priest is wagging his finger. But the focal point, the thing your eyes are attracted to, is the candle on the table, isn't it? As if the artist is wanting to say to us, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And there is light on the table. If I spoke the truth, Jesus said, as he bears his witness in the middle of the darkness, if I spoke the truth, and it's a faithful witness that has blazed the trail for countless thousands of his disciples across the centuries. You know, Luther at Worms in 1521, here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. Dietrich Bonhoeffer before the Nazis in 1944, Archbishop Jelani Luwum before his Ugandan interrogators in 1977, or the countless unnamed martyrs for Jesus through recent decades in Red China, Eastern Europe, Africa, South America, Asia. This light will change the picture everywhere. The powers that be, already committed to a verdict before they found the evidence, working to the maxim Caiaphas had given them, it would be good if one man died for the people, discover they've simply traced God's eternal purposes. A Messiah who would take the judgment his people deserve for their sins. So you see, as Peter would describe on the day of Pentecost, Annas and the others were just working through God's great rescue plan of the cross. They schemed and plotted. And all they came up with was what was in God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. It led to the great act of salvation that was the cross. Now, don't mishear me. The darkness is real. The growing isolation of Jesus as Judas betrays, as disciples flee, as Peter denies. All painfully real, and there's more to come on the cross as the Father forsakes him. But it means, as the writer to the Hebrews puts it, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted in every way as we are, yet he did not sin. See, for thousands of nameless Christians living and suffering in obscurity, feeling unnoticed and forgotten and abandoned, they look to a God who is able to say of their isolation, I've been there. I do know how it feels. The power players always look overwhelming. I must not let my mind imagine they can derail God's deliberate plan. And then there's Peter. And in the darkness of his denial shines this light. The failure is not final. See, the cock began to crow. It had been all too predictable, but it was not end of story. John spared us the details of Peter's swearing and oaths in the denial, or his tears as he realizes what he's done. You'll need to read Peter's own account in Mark's Gospel if you want to know about that. John isn't trying to rub salt in the wounds. He records the denial. But then a few chapters later, he's going to record Peter's restoring as well, as Jesus meets with him. Peter, whose shoes fit so comfortably on so many of us. Peter, whose self-confidence has been so thoroughly collapsed. I'll lay down my life for you. Really? So deep in the darkness. And he still has a part to play. God's entrusted his gospel message to a few. He's given them a world to reach, a hostile culture to bear witness in. And he uses a coward like Peter. See, today, we're not here at All Souls as a church just to survive. We're in the business of reaching out to a world, trying to win a world, a culture that may be more and more hostile to witness in, but with a God who still uses the Peters of this world. I can't face the mission task and simply renew my membership of the Cowards Club and keep my head down as if there couldn't possibly be a part for me to play. Or could I? We've tasted the dark. Yes, we all taste the dark. But will you stay in the dark? Or are you going to keep your eye on the candle, the light on the table? Head there. Head to the Jesus who spoke the truth, who renews and restores and uses the coward. Our final hymn's got a chorus with massive confidence. We will stand as children of the promise. But, friends, you can't sing that unless first you've faced the dark. Unless first you've cried to the Lord in your weakness, in my weakness. So before we sing, we'll be quiet. Before we sing, we'll take the silence to speak personally with our Lord.